For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, two of the most intelligent Neanderthal-type folks that you're ever going to run into.
We're not even human anymore.
That's so. Right. We continue to devolve.
Well, no.
After a couple of years of the show.
If you've seen anything about the studies of the human genome, you'll discover that all of us probably have some Neanderthal genes still in us. It's just that in some of us it expresses more profoundly than in others.
Right. But we didn't even hit the status of Neanderthals this time. We were Neanderthal-like creatures.
Correct.
Well, which defines Homo sapien.
All right.
We've got that. Therefore, back to names. Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle. Guys.
Howdy.
This past week, we saw the March for Our Lives, a national movement, predominantly under the direction of students, young people, and the focus was on guns and gun violence. Now, violence is, it's part of humanity. We're mm-hmm. the only creatures that, on a regular basis kill our own. Where do we go with that from a philosophical standpoint? Are we naturally violent? Is there something that can be done to curb that violence? Or, where do we as Catholics fall along the lines of thinking in a measure like this?
Yeah, I think on face value, the answer to your first question, are we as a species naturally violent? I think the answer, just given all the evidence of human history, it has to be a pretty obvious yes. However,
I think it's the consequence, one of the consequences of original sin.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're fallen.
Right. Human nature is fallen, mm-hmm. at least human nature as it's presented now. And to uncover that and to get behind kind of what human nature was originally like, that takes a lot of philosophical work, and that's a large process to try to recover what were Adam and Eve like. That's really what John Paul II did with Theology of the Body, mm-hmm. is he really tried to dig philosophically into the primordial conscience, that sort of givenness of humanity before it became tainted and before the fall.
Yeah, I think what I've been reading some articles on some what I would call reliable Catholic periodicals online, sources that are known to be solid in terms of their Catholic orthodoxy. And what I've noticed recently as it pertains to this idea of fallen human nature as part of the explanation for, or maybe the fundamental explanation for violence, is people are beginning to, some theologians and Catholic thinkers are beginning to recover St. Augustine on this point, where St. Augustine, known as Doctor of the Church, right, known as the Doctor of Grace, Augustine takes a pretty dim view of fallen human nature. By that I mean, he thinks the fall is very severe, and that it's only and therefore attributes much to God's grace, hence Doctor of Grace, in our ability to really perform any type of action that's good. He has this. I'll use a Calvinist term. Because I think Calvin reads Augustine and arrives at this point, which is this sense of depravity, right? That human nature is so fallen that we're depraved, and it's only God's grace that is able to build upon that fallen human nature such that we can perform any good whatsoever.
Right. And, you know, Augustine came from the Roman world and towards the mm-hmm. end of it. So it had decayed to a certain extent.
Yeah, he saw kind of the quote-unquote fall of it, if you will.
Right. But, you know, as we were talking with Dr. Vost last week about friendship, you have these very noble, very virtuous pagans in Aristotle, in Plato, in Cicero, in Seneca, in, you know, so that the pagans were able to kind of achieve this sort of virtue in some ways, you know, I don't know that Augustine would agree totally outside the grace of God. I think Augustine would argue that, no, they've been beneficiaries of grace as well. But that almost stands as a counter a little bit, I think, to the idea of complete total depravity.
Yeah, total depravity is where Calvin, I think, goes too far, is where Calvin would go, and he takes Augustine too far, the total depravity. What I would say, though, what I think is happening, though, with this sort of retrieval of Augustine on his theological and philosophical writings on the fall, is that it seems to be very helpful as a sort of antidote or corrective to the prevailing attitudes of, well, we're all good people.
Right.
You know,
right.
That sort of silliness.
Yeah, yeah. The noble savage, the myth of the noble savage that came out of the Enlightenment.
Well, or even just people thinking about themselves as, well, I'm basically a good person, you know, therefore, you know, I'm not really in need of salvation. I don't need sacraments. I don't need religion. I'm basically a good person. Yes, I'm not perfect. Yes, I make mistakes. It's that mindset, that sort of what is it called the moral therapeutic
deism, right?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. That's the God.
God,
right?
Kind of set everything in motion, stood back, but now he's there to be our counselor.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Then gives some, I'm moral in the sense that I'm trying to do good, but there really is no objective, you know, standards by which I can measure myself. It's therapeutic in that it can make me feel good. It can make me, gives me a sense of maybe belonging or purpose. And it's, you know, it's something kind of outside myself to a certain extent.
Right. And it's deism, because it believes that God is basically standing back.
The watchmaker. He made the watch, and now he's walked away.
He's not involved in everybody being an essence and existence.
He's got a whole universe to run, Mark.
But you know, when we need him.
Trifle with us.
Yeah. When we need him, he's there. You know, he's reliably there when we need him. But otherwise, you know, he stands back.
So. And I think Augustine's pointing to, I think with this word, the resurgence, Augustine is reminding us that no, things are far worse to a certain extent than that. That our condition is far worse, and therefore, which from that we ought not to despair, but rather recognize our total dependence on God, on how much we need God, how much we need Holy Mother Church, the sacraments, the teachings, deification, the growth in holiness and virtue. That's what it should signal to us, instead of the happy clappy, I'm okay, you're okay, I don't, you know, just I can manage this whole thing on my own.
Right. And incidents of school shootings, incidents of other violence, I mean, you know, the amount of violence that goes on a daily basis that's just sort of under the radar that nobody even pays attention to is immense.
That was Chesterton's point, right? G.K. Chesterton's point was the reason why, one of the reasons why he was so convinced that Christianity was right was because the doctrine of original sin, and the proof was that all you had to do was read the paper.
Right. Yeah.
Back in his day, you read the paper, you see all the horrible things that are going on, and you can't help but see you can't help but conclude that humanity is fallen.
Right. And, you know, I think also with, as you mentioned, you know, God's grace helps to alleviate this. And it doesn't just help to alleviate this on an individual basis where we're pursuing holiness, where we're more making ourselves into the image and likeness of that all beneficent, all good, you know, beyond good God. In that individual process, that has ramifications society wide. So, you know, I think there is a certain amount of progress, so to speak, when you look at society, but mainly because of Christianity. And I think, you know, as we're kind of losing that Christian sense of identity within culture. I think there's a little bit of a reversion backwards in some ways towards more and more violence. Although I Pinkerton recently came out with a book that shows there's less violence now in the world than there's ever been. So I guess there's kind of counters to that argument as well.
Well, it seems if the move away, what we may be headed for is the move away from the Christian religion, and especially specifically the Catholic religion, and its moral precepts, and its under and the sacraments building, as vehicles of grace, building on nature. I would say one of the scenarios we're likely to face would be a kind of neo-barbarism, and that in that setting, when you no longer have, and this is one of the critiques of postmodernism, when you no longer have, when you deny objective reality, deny objective moral standards, what you are left with, I think, is simply power, and that it's power at work. And when since the best way to resolve, or I maybe not best, but a frequent way you resolve power struggles is through violence.
Yeah, because power struggles ultimately break down into some form of envy. The reason why you have a power struggle is not so much that the other person has power over me, but because you resent that, or vice versa, the person who has power over resents something that the other person has. And so there's an envy that goes on that leads to a certain extent. I think to a certain extent, envy is kind of the root cause of just about every act of violence that you see. So, that envy, but it doesn't always manifest itself directly. I think there's a kind of indirect, indirect envy. René Girard, late Catholic philosopher, really explored this idea of kind of how envy works on a societal level and how it is that it sort of manifests itself in really primordial violence, but the violence that we see kind of on an everyday level too.
Well, you know what? We're going to need to take a break, but when we come back, let's pick that up, Mark. Let's talk a little bit more about René Girard and some of his, again, a great Catholic thinker of the 20th century. And you're listening to The Catholic Cave. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Hi, I'm Will Hampton, longtime local sportscaster, happy to be back on the local airwaves right here on Catholic Radio Indy. Join me for Catholic Sports Weekly every week at 4 p.m. on both Tuesdays and Friday. We'll be interviewing local and national sports figures, connecting their Catholic faith to the sports that we all love. Also, we'll be looking at scores from last week and the upcoming schedules for local Catholic schools and CYO sports. Our program is underwritten in part by Catholic Athletes for Christ. Join us each Tuesday and Friday at 4 right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, here with Kent Blanford, and we are still slowly trying to, I think, unpack the cause of violence. Violence has been in the headlines recently. There've been protests. We had the March for Our Lives recently to kind of, I think, indirectly protest the violence. The protest was actually, protest against gun laws, but the cause of that ultimately was school violence, and so we're talking a little bit about the causes of violence. And of course, when you talk about the causes of violence, particularly on a Catholic radio program, I think inevitably you're going to get to the thought of René Girard. He's the one that's explored that idea the most, at least most recently. And Girard's idea starts with this insight that he had about envy, that envy doesn't manifest itself as me simply envying you and wanting to take what you have and you envying me and wanting to take what I have, that this desire for possessions is really a desire to be like somebody else. That we have this somewhat inherent desire within humanity. I think it's ultimately based in the fact that we're made in God's image and likeness and then fallen away from that. But we have this desire to imitate, to want to be somebody else, to want to take on the characteristics of somebody else. And the closer you get to that model that you've patterned yourself off of, the more the envy starts to kick in and the more envious you become. So, that's sort of the root, I think, of Girard's thinking into sort of where violence within humanity stems and where it comes from.
Yeah, I think the that's a good explanation. I think to round that off too would be, as I've read Girard, our desires are come about because of this because we want to mimic someone else,
right?
And so his theory is called mimetic theory, and in that we want to, just as you were saying, Mark, We want to be like the other person, such that we want to imitate them,
right?
And we want to mirror them. And as you point out, as one draws closer to them, one, great friendships can form because you can begin desire the same things. You can see that in friendship. But what Girard will point out is there are also times, though, where that will result because of there's scarcity, for example. There's we both, Mark, say, for example, desire the same woman, and we could be the best of friends, but then this woman comes along and she sort of captivates both of us. Well, what can happen then is then a rivalry will emerge, and then from the rivalry you'll then have a kind of competition. And then from that it can then devolve into a actual conflict,
right?
And you see it all the time in you see it all the time in some of these romantic stories about, although you don't see it played out too much in current settings where two guys want the same woman, but you don't have to go back very far into the literature or films to see where that was far more common, where two guys were competing for the affections, two friends even, or two brothers would be competing for the affection of this desirable woman. And it inevitably often would result in this kind of destructive rivalry.
Right. And as Girard points out, you know, the desire there, yeah, I'm sure there's a desire for the woman herself, but what causes that rivalry is not so much the desire for the woman, but the desire to have and be and become
like the other
person. The other person. Exactly.
Yeah.
To imitate the other person.
Yeah, all of, not all, but the vast majority of advertising plays off this. Because what do you see in advertising? You watch a commercial, well, you see someone, you know, it's a Nike commercial, right? So you see someone, they're going to present someone in a very attractive person in a very attractive setting to us, such that when we see their shoes, we want to have those shoes, so we too can be an attractive person in an attractive setting.
Right. And taking a step back away from Girard's philosophy to look at this a little bit theologically, you know, what somebody's doing in this, and almost what we do on an everyday basis, which is really scary. I think this goes back to what we were talking about in the first segment of just how depraved and how far fallen humanity really is. We're making gods out of our interactions, out of the people we meet, out of the things that we see, out of the advertisements. Really, honestly, we're making foreign gods out of our entire life. And, you know, I think the reason why that happens is because we have this displaced instinct to desire God and ultimately to try to imitate God and ultimately to try to become like God. And that instinct becomes misplaced. And I think that, you know, theologically is sort of the root of what Girard had noticed in this sort of mimetic rivalry that mimetic means, you know, imitative. So this imitative
think
rivalry.
Think of mimes.
Right, exactly.
Right, pantomimes.
Right, right. But yeah, the sort of imitation based on rivalries to where we're imitating the person we rival and we want the same things that they have. And it's at a very subconscious level often, but it does seem to drive a huge amount of human behavior.
Well, right. Even he'll say even in Girard, I think we'll point out even in where they're saying an explicit kind of hatred between two people. Think of high school, right? Think of high school where say Mark, you and I were schoolmates and we can't stand each other. Right. And so, you know, when I see you, I just smoke comes out my ears. Right. And vice versa. Well, one of the ways this imitation work is actually in a sort of an opposite or kind of a repulsive fashion, meaning that when I see you as my enemy, and I notice that you're wearing certain clothes, certain shoes, which are a big deal in high school, I now, instead of desiring what you're wearing because you're my rival, I go out of my way to make sure I don't imitate you at all. So it actually works. It can actually work in reverse when there's explicit rivals, in that I'll never own what you own. I'll never wear my hair the way you wear your hair. I'll never wear the same shoes you wear, you know. And in a certain sense, that's, you're still dry. It's still dry. I now have a desire not to imitate, but actually to be the opposite of. And that's driving a lot. That's going to drive my behavior and my choices and things as well. I have this sort of anti-desire.
Right. And the object of our fixation. And by object, it's almost always a person, according to Girard. So, you know, there's always a model. That
exemplars.
You are,
exemplar. Yeah.
And where these rivals come about is because two people have the same exemplar. It's not necessarily that I'm your rival because I want to be like you, although that happens too. But more often than not, it's I'm your rival because both of us want to be like somebody else.
Yes.
We're both trying.
We're
both competing to be like somebody else.
Here's another one that comes up. I think another example of that would be, let's say we're coworkers, right? Let's say we're coworkers and we basically have the same job. We're at the same level. We're at the same point in our careers. And that next step up, that position opens, right? That next promotion opportunity presents itself to you and I. We're normally on good terms. We're friends at work and we get along. But now that opportunity presents itself and we both want it.
Right.
And we both have been working towards it. Well, this is where you picture, there's a picture, you know, one guy putting his hey, let me put my arm around your shoulder because we're buds. And in my other hand, I'm hiding the knife.
Right.
Right. Because what I'm really doing to you, Mark, is I'm going to figure out where I can put the knife in your back so that I can advance. So even though we're friends, we now become rivals because we desire the same, we're desiring the same sort of opportunity.
Right. And what has changed in that relationship? Well, nothing's really changed in the fact between the two people.
Yeah, it's not anything you or I did.
But it's what but what's changed is what we both desire. Suddenly something has come up that now we both desire that
and we both can't have it.
And we both can't
have
it.
And that's where the scarcity comes in, right? This sort of limited resources come in. Where, to zoom out a little bit, where Girard begins to do analysis, say, at the societal level, he'll notice, he'll draw to our attention. And I preface this by saying he read widely of ancient literature and studying ancient civilization. So this pattern that I'm going to bring up as I've come to understand him, is what he identified, I think, as patterns that's been repeated throughout civilizations.
Right, because he first noticed these patterns in French, contemporary French literature. And reading, you know, Proust and other French writers like that, and Shakespeare as well. So, you know, he noticed it in I think, more modern contemporary context, and then looked back at
started
the ancient literature
back.
And said, hey, that same trend is there. But, you know, when he looks at it from a societal level, what he sees is that these patterns, they're contagious. They're almost like diseases that spread throughout a society. And so you know, as I start to have rivals with other people have rivals not only with me, but they have rivalries for other things with other people. And suddenly, you know, the contagion of conflict that's created by these rivals spreads society wide.
Right. And this is where you will see factions form. So he'll point to factions could be like one tribe, a dominant, you know, larger, more powerful tribe against a smaller tribe. But it almost always will result in at some point sort of the many against the few or the all against one. And that will be in society, you begin to see how in this sort of pattern, you're going to begin to see how this fellow feeling, I'll bring up, amongst the many against the one or the few begins to fuel this violence that eventually is going to lead into a ritual violence. And with that, we're going to need to take another break. We're already halfway through. Stay tuned. We're just unpacking Rene Girard, about his mimetic theory about violence.
And we'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
Besides going to Mass every Sunday, we're all encouraged to spend some time with our Lord each week, to shut out distractions, present our prayers to God, and then just listen. In today's hectic world, that sounds impossible, doesn't it? Well, chances are there's an adoration chapel in a Catholic church not far from where you live, a place where you can spend an hour or just a few minutes in the real presence of our Lord in the Blessed Sacrament, in a quiet, peaceful atmosphere where you can really talk to Jesus. And more importantly, He can talk to you. Many chapels are open 24 hours a day. Here are some of the places where you'll find adoration chapels: at Our Lady of Mount Carmel, St. Alphonsus in Zionsville, St. Louis de Montfort in Fishers, and St. Maria Gravetti in Westfield. Why not stop by soon? Jesus is there, and He is waiting to talk to you.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford. And, you know, we started off, Kent, with your question about school violence. And, you know, we've been kind of getting deep into the philosophical weeds, talking about Rene Girard's theory of violence, where it comes from, that it comes from those rivalries that spring up because we all have common desires. We all desire the same things. Of course, we can't all have the same things because there's scarcity. So because of that, these rivalries develop between us, and they often become violent. You know, that violence, you know, the violence we see is ultimately traced back to this envy and rivalry that we have because we all desire the same things that we can't have. And often those desires manifest themselves not so much in desiring a thing, but in desiring wanting to be like somebody else. So, you know, our desire for things are ultimately rooted in our desire to be like somebody else, which in my opinion is ultimately rooted in how we're made in the image and likeness of God, that we desire to be like God by nature, but we kind of transfer that and shift that.
Misguided,
right, exactly. So when you've got a situation where everybody is desiring the same things, we're all becoming rivals, you can see how society becomes violent very quickly. And this, you know, this almost contagious, you know, Girard uses the word contagious violence.
Mm-hmm.
To control that spread, there has to be some sort of mechanism. Otherwise, it's going to completely mm-hmm. destroy society. It goes back, we were talking about Augustine and you know, the idea that man is much more fallen than we ever really seem to think. Mm-hmm. And Girard would kind of point out, yeah, you know, we're so fallen that we would destroy ourselves if we didn't have certain checks on this.
Right.
And
I think the check that he brings up, I think it's a, is the scapegoating mechanism.
Right.
The scapegoating mechanism in society is how this building up of a violent tension eventually erupts and is released. And it takes the form of the majority either, you know, sort of expunging its community of this person or minority group. And by that, I mean not necessarily ethnic minority, although that's often the case, or religious minority, but someone, the other, he would call it, the different, and driving them out or killing them. Now, to Christians, hearing the word scapegoat, we have a very particular contemporary understanding of that term that is new from a historical standpoint. So prior to Christianity, the scapegoating mechanism was really seen as a viable way for societies to deal with these internal conflicts and rivalry by saying, for example, by you will see the ritual, you'll see the majority sort of gang up, if you will, against a smaller, weaker faction and either drive them out or kill them. And when they kill them, it's at that a couple of things are happening at that moment. One is the majority have this fellow feeling of solidarity of us against them, that we're in the right and these are the people to, this is the person or people to blame. They're the ones that have caused the harm. They're the ones that are getting in our way. So we're justified in destroying them. And in that moment of destroying them, they realize that there's a kind of release because now our enemy has been vanquished. And that feels good. And so that, and therefore, and then time moves forward, and inevitably, again, through mimetic theory, you're going to see what? Rivalry and conflict begin to build up and rise again, and it needs to be repeated. And they begin to see that, Girard begins to see in these ancient civilizations, this repetition leads to religious ritualization. That it becomes this killing, the scapegoating mechanism becomes a part of a sacred ritual. There's a sacred violence that takes place, and then that becomes attributed to the gods. The gods are calling for us to make these sacrifices, and you'll see it depicted. I love Mel Gibson's movie Apocalypto, very, very much overlooked, but there's a depiction in there of, I think it's the Inca civilization who are experiencing this tremendous drought. So what do they do to appease the sun god so that it will rain is they go out into small remote villages. They capture the men, bring them back, and then drag them up to the top of those giant pyramid things where they behead them one at a time as sacrificial offerings to the sun god until there's enough bloodshed that the sun gods are appeased and it begins to rain. And so these guys are the scapegoat, and it's completely justified from a religious standpoint. And there's the scapegoat mechanism on full display.
Right. And the origin of the scapegoat mechanism is really to try to restore peace within the community.
Well, that's what happens. Once you scapegoat, you've killed your enemy. There's in that sort of victory, peace, everything's been released, all the tension's been released, and you're right, peace ensues.
Right, and so ultimately, you know, as human history progresses, justice and a system of laws and a system of courts and you know, a way of being able to resolve these mimetic disputes in a more, I guess, traditional sense of having a courtroom and police force and all the modern trappings that we have. Eventually, that kind of covers all of this sort of, I think, ritual mechanism that was there to control the violence. We now have a system of justice to control the violence. So I think, you know, when you go back and you look at the school shootings of what's going on when you have violence like this erupt on a somewhat systematic level. I mean, school shootings are still relatively rare. They make the headlines because they're
horrendous,
exactly. Yeah. But luckily, they are still somewhat rare, although they're happening more and more frequently. But I think you've got to go back and kind of look for, why is there a feeling of injustice that violence is the only way to remedy this? And, you know, if Girard's theories are right, the violence isn't always going to be against the rival. It's not always going to be against the person that's perpetrating the violence. It's going to be an attempt to try to expunge the evil that's creating the violence. And so, you know, I think when you get some of the kids that are more unstable, and a lot of these kids that are involved in the school shootings have mental problems, they have mental disabilities that have been documented. You know, I think when you look at that, you can kind of start to see this same pattern that Gerard described is a great explanation for what's happening in these schools.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point too about the you know, often the shooters in these cases are very troubled kids and come from often, not always, there's no sort of exclusivity as to the pattern, but generally, you know, broken homes. I've read, for example, after Columbine, I wrote a paper on Columbine and some of the contributing factors. I read the FBI report. You can get it online. And it's no one thing, but when we talk about imitation, which is kind of what we're talking about here, Gerard, with René Girard, one factor that does seem to recur over and over again are violent video games. And that was very prevalent in the lives of the two shooters at Columbine. And again, it's not to say, you know, I don't want to be misunderstood, because then immediately you say, oh, video, tends to blaming video games, you know, for the violence. I'm saying no. It's, but the FBI's own report recognizes that it's a factor. And when you think about how realistic first-person shooter games are today with the technology, it's very realistic. And what it does is it creates, it begins to habituate one. Those who are susceptible, which is a very small percentage of the population, but it's not zero, right? It doesn't influence most of us playing that would play a violent video game. We're not going to turn to shoot, right? That's not what's generally going to happen. But we do know that when you take a large enough sample of the population, there's the 1-3% of people may have a problem with, and they do. And so you see that again as a factor. And these, even the military uses a realistic first person shooter games to train them to kill. And so you saw in Columbine, for example, is it has the certain minds, and remember, adolescents are still forming. It can deaden one's conscience, right? It can habituate one to the act of tracking down, putting in one's sights, pulling the trigger and watching, you know, heads explode in a bloody fashion right in front of you on the screen. And again, I'm not making a generalization that violent video games turns people into, but there's a segment of our population that does become a factor in among many other factors as part of the explanation of what's transpired.
Yeah, I think in addition to sort of deadening the conscience to the acts of violence, I think the worlds that these video games create and that a person immerses themselves in when they play them leads us to a different idea of justice. You're operating in a world with a different set of rules. And it's not that...
Or no rules,
right, exactly. And it's not that you lose sight of the difference between video game world and real world, but it's that habituation. You get into patterns of acting in certain ways within the video game world that make it easier to act in those ways in the real world.
Yeah, and it's maybe a bit of an adult theme for a quick second, but I think of like a game like, and not to get too far off the topic, but like Grand Theft Auto, where in a game like Grand Theft Auto, your character is one of the characters you can do is you can be a drug dealer. So you can for fun. So just think about that. So for fun here, hey, what are you doing this weekend, Tim? Well, I'm going to play a drug dealer in a video game, and I'm going to, spend hours figuring out how to distribute, you know, illegal narcotics for money. And I'm going to interact with prostitutes, and I'm going to kill people in this video game for fun. That's how I'm gonna let pressure off my. I mean, the desire. I mean, again, what I call into question is why, and I don't know. I don't have a good answer for it. Why does that sound like something someone wants to do for leisure? right? To act out that way. And if there's, so there's already a step, right? There's already a step towards desiring the wrong thing where you're like, hey, Mark, you're probably going to adoration for an hour. I'm going to be playing, you know, a violent drug lord in a video game for hours, right. For an hour. You know, it's not neutral how we're spending our time on what's going to happen to not just our souls, but, you know, how I think of the world. How you and I are going to think of the world can be completely different when I think it's fun to do what I'm doing and you're spending an hour in adoration. It's just, we're on two different paths.
Right. And once again, just to reiterate, you know, that this is not the whole cause of any of these violence. I mean, there's so many different factors, but it's important, I think, for us to start speculating about these things, to start kind of digging, to start
at least talk about it
and discuss it. And, you know, I think people, when they look at philosophy and they look at particularly Catholic philosophy, they think of it not so much as a speculative enterprise as a descriptive enterprise. So, you know, you don't go through philosophy to try to figure things out. You go through philosophy to try to describe what's already there. And, you know, that's really kind of far from the truth. I think there's an active part of philosophy that the church allows and the church encourages that allows us to kind of explore ideas with the understanding that sometimes we're going to be dead wrong. Sometimes we're going to come up with thoughts like, oh, you know, the video games are definitely contributing to this and we're going to be proven wrong eventually. But the church and the Catholic philosophical tradition encourages that rather than discourages that. So we're coming up upon a break. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the nature of Catholic philosophy and how it is that it allows us to explore things like school violence in a sort of safe way.
And we'll be back with more of The Cave right after this.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Holy Spirit at Geist will welcome Mr. Hector Salcido, former organist and cantor at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and current music director at St. Malachy, for a musical performance in partnership with the parish choir and musicians, Friday, April 13th at 7 p.m. This concert will benefit Ascent 121, an Indianapolis-based organization providing treatment for survivors of the sex trafficking of minors here in the Indianapolis and Fishers areas. Admission is free, with opportunities for giving to Ascent 121 while in attendance. A chance to visit with Hector, the musicians, and representatives from Ascent 121 will follow, with light snacks and coffee and tea to be served. For questions or more event information, please contact Kevin Walters at kmartinwalters@gmail.com. For more information about Ascent 121, please visit ascent121.org.
Welcome back again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Kent Blanford, Timothy O'Donnell, and we have been talking about the causes of violence, particularly the causes of school violence. We talked a lot about the theories of René Girard, the great Catholic philosopher, theologian. In a lot of ways, what Girard did, I like to think of it this way, is he took a lot of postmodern thought, and he did what St. Thomas Aquinas did with Aristotle's thought. This is thought that has always seemed sort of outside the bounds of Catholicism, always sort of seemed like this isn't something that good Catholic philosophers should be dealing with, and he Christianized it. He came up with a way to utilize postmodern thought in ways that advances the project of Christianity to a certain extent. And so we're taking some of his ideas and some of his thoughts and kind of trying to analyze school violence and the cause of school violence. And right before the break, I kind of brought up the realization that we're doing a lot of speculating here, Tim. I don't want any of our listeners to go away with, well, you know, Mark and Tim think they have the definitive answer to, you know, school violence or what the causes are. But I think that's important to kind of bring up, that this is okay. it's okay to speculate, and it's okay to use the resources that we get from people like Girard, that we get from people like St. Thomas Aquinas, that we get from people like St. Augustine, to try to piece together sort of the mysteries of human existence.
Right, and to try to take the Holy Mother Church, for example, is always trying to represent the splendor of truth, if you will, into the contemporary setting, whatever, you know, as we march forward in time, things just sometimes need to be restated or clarified. We also, you know, recognize that there's a development that occurs, not a rupture, but a development in Christian doctrine. So by making use of, speculating in this sphere of philosophy is us trying to advance the conversation into expand the sphere of the Catholic intellectual tradition in a way that that we recognize we're not going to get it all right, because we're trying to propose new sets. We're trying to propose new sets of understanding. We're trying to garner more knowledge. We're trying to grow in wisdom. And we recognize, again, as fallen human beings, that we're also going to We're going to make mistakes. And this is why the intellectual virtue, it's not just an intellectual virtue, but the virtue of humility is so important, to recognize that, you know, there is a God and we're not it.
Right. And I think it's also important, I think, to recognize sort of the realm of authority that the church has. And,
yes,
and
yeah.
that, you know, the authority of the church is not all encompassing. What the church proposes about herself is that she has been the recipient of divine revelation, and she is the custodian of that revelation, and that that revelation can be expounded upon. It can be we can use human reason to kind of further it and draw out implications and figure out what it means and go beyond what's been revealed. But the church's real role is protecting that deposit of the faith, that has been given to us by revelation. The rest of it, though, really is a speculative enterprise.
Yeah, for theologians and philosophers alike. I maybe the a metaphor that might be helpful is or a term at least is, you know, if we're doing theology and philosophy actively, then we're on the frontier. And frontier, I think, is a good way to sort of capture that idea of that to one's back is where we've been and what's familiar, but what's in front of us is still the unknown, and we're eager to explore it and to make new discoveries, and then to reconcile discoveries with what's already come before. So that, and that's how we're going to be able to eventually not only advance the conversation, but we also, as we make these discoveries, we're able to we'll be able to determine ourselves or those who follow whether or not we got it right, because it will either be in continuity or in rupture with what's come before.
Right. You know, St. John Paul II wrote Veritatis et Splendor. When he wrote that, I think what he was, you know, a lot of Catholic intellectuals were a little concerned from that. That what he was calling for was a call back to Thomistic thought, Thomistic philosophy, in a restrictive sort of way, because he held up St. Thomas as the model of what Catholic intellectual pursuits ought to look like. But I really think what John Paul II had in mind was more along what you were just talking about, Tim, that St. Thomas is a great model of that pushing Catholic thought to the frontier, going and exploring new territory, exploring new ideas, and then reconciling it with what's come before us. Because, you know, when St. Thomas started off with Aristotle, Aristotle was a pagan, non-Christian, you know, this was not something that good Catholics would study. And so when St. Thomas sort of reintroduced Aristotle into the Western world, it was revolutionary. He was roundly criticized for it, but eventually, you know, this became sort of the standard of what Catholic philosophy should look like and what Catholic philosophy is.
Yeah, what the enterprise should look like. You're right. And that's also why it's so important to have a good command of faith and reason. All right. It's both. And again, another great encyclical, right?
And actually, that's the one I was trying to refer to. I just
Fetus ad ratio.
Fetus ad ratio.
Yeah,
That's the one where St. John Paul II lays out St. Thomas Aquinas as kind of a model for.
I think you're right, though. In Veritatis Splendor, though, it's a call back. I actually think that one, which is the Splendor of Truth in English, I think in that one, the Splendor of Truth, he is also making a call, there's a corrective in there in that moral, as we've talked about with like After Virtue with McIntyre, where moral, St. John Paul the Great puts his finger on that much of moral philosophy, even in Catholic circles, had sort of veered off course because there was a refutation of intrinsically evil is one of the primary correctives, and it was a hearkening back to we can't dispense with that. So some acts are in and of themselves, but he didn't just retrieve and just sort of copy paste from old, but he retrieved from the tradition and then represented it fresh and anew as a continuation in standing in that trajectory of the tradition, but also to call others who maybe had wandered off back into the lane that we should be in as a Catholic philosophers.
And St. John Paul II was only able to do this because he himself had studied a great deal of philosophy.
He's probably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century and maybe probably even well beyond that.
Right. But you know, the role of the church to a certain extent within, I mean, as St. John Paul II was in some ways able to go beyond even the role of the church and engage in a lot of these same projects just because of who he was as a person.
Oh yeah.
Role of Mother Church is once again to kind of be that safeguard of the deposit of faith. And when those who are exploring that frontier of thought go way outside the bounds of that, they're to gently, or maybe even sometimes not so gently, call them back. And that's really the role of the church, at least as the defender of the faith.
Right. So maybe two quick examples might be, so St. John Paul the Great really did much, as did St. Teresa Benedict of the Cross, in terms of sort of, you made the, of sort of, I want to say Christianizing Edmund Husserl's phenomenology, and that's you know, very much both of those great saints, in fact, Saint Teresa of the Cross was Husserl's student, and very much took his teachings and didn't swallow them whole, but discerningly incorporated them into our thinking and understanding. That's now very much a part of the Catholic intellectual tradition, and is clearly an advancement from what had come before, because it simply didn't exist. Phenomenally, simply did not exist as a school of thought, and that's really what I think speculation is at its very best, is making an advancement and then discerningly, carefully, and over time, being on that frontier, exploring new ideas, and then having the not just the scholarly expertise, but the humility to also stand corrected, because there were plenty of people, here we're at the 50-year anniversary of Humanae Vitae, plenty of really smart, talented, gifted theologians and philosophers that completely got Humanae Vitae wrong and dissented from it, right? And that's an example of where Holy Mother Church, to the extent that they rejected the teachings of Humanae Vitae, Holy Mother Church calls them back into what? Conformity with the truth.
Right. And I think that's a great example because, you know, when Humanae Vitae came out, I don't know that the church really had the capability. I mean, there were great Catholic thinkers and great Catholic philosophers at the time, but I'm not sure that the church really had the ability to philosophically refute
We might have to take that up. I might disagree with you.
But, you know, and as I'm saying it, I mean, there can be some misunderstanding what I'm saying.
We're out of time, though, Mark.
We are a little bit out of time. Are we totally out of time,
We're
Ken?
Totally out of time, Ken.
We'll have to take up how the church refutes itself on another show.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for this week. We'll pick it up next week and the week after that and the week after that. So stay tuned. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, and this is all for the Catholic Cave for this week. God bless. The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.